Iowa's quest to become the healthiest state isn't just about our physical health. Today, we're going to talk about emotional health and well-being. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's a day on the Hill for the Healthiest State Initiative. And as participants around the state are in the first week of their Live Healthy Iowa Challenge, we're going to focus on another part of the initiative. With us today is University of Northern Iowa President Ben Allen. He's cabinet chair of the Emotional Health and Lifelong Learning component of the initiative. We'll also talk today about how physical health impacts our emotional health and explore how music and laughter can lift our spirits. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's a day on the Hill today for Iowa's Healthiest State Initiative. The Live Healthy Iowa 10-Week Fitness Challenge began this week, and visitors to the Capitol today will have a chance to learn a few things about their own health and also to learn more about the many different facets of the Healthiest State Initiative. This hour, we're going to focus on emotional health and well-being. I'll talk with a kinesiologist about the relationship between exercise and physical health and our mental and emotional health. We'll also explore using music and laughter to raise our spirits and improve our well-being. To start off the hour, I have with me University of Northern Iowa President Ben Allen. He is also the cabinet chair of the Emotional Health and Lifelong Learning component of the Healthiest State Initiative. Hello, President Allen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we have been hearing a lot about efforts to make Iowans healthier through exercise, getting people moving, helping them lose weight. Why is this component, with a focus on emotional health, important to the Healthiest State Initiative?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for the focus on this area. First of all, there's more research indicating the connection between emotional health and physical health, and that research has been well documented. But secondly, I think in particular for my involvement was some evidence that on the metrics that we use in the state to measure how we were doing, we had some challenges in one area of the emotional health index.
Be more specific. What were the challenges?
Well, again, this is the Gallup HealthWays measure of well-being, and there are six areas, one being emotional health, and that's based upon a number of different measures, but one was how much people were learning, so to speak. The question that was asked by Gallup, and is asked every day, by the way, is did you learn or do something interesting yesterday? And that was the question that Iowans did not score as well as many of the other individuals across the nation.
Oh, interesting. And draw the connection. We were talking about how research has shown us a direct connection between physical health and our emotional well-being, and we are going to dig into that research in just a couple of minutes with a kinesiologist. But tell me about the connection between well-being and lifelong learning.
Well, lifelong learning is an interesting piece of this because it suggests that people feel better about themselves if they tackle a problem, learn about it, able to master it, and then use that information to do more things. And it's connected to not only how they feel about themselves, self-esteem, but also allows them to have more independence in terms of what they know and how to use that knowledge.
What are some of the ways that the Healthiest State Initiative has been working to try to help people live a more intellectually stimulating life?
Well, that is our task, and we'll be looking at that. But in general, the Healthiest State Initiative has programs now that deals with this. For instance, it's related to stress, for instance, and the programs that they had started last year, including family together time, where families do have dinner time together. A surprisingly low percentage of teenagers indicate that they have dinner with their families, less than 60%. But this is a good way to deal with the emotional health issues. The Healthiest State Initiative also encourage people to volunteer because there is a researchers call the helper's high, where if you provide good services to other people. You feel better about yourself and your affects your health. Physical fitness, of course, is a part of this issue. The more you have exercise, the more you exercise, the better you feel emotionally. And so it's all tied together. The learning piece is connected to the score that we ranked lower than many other states. I think we were 23rd on that particular question in terms of did you learn something or do something interesting. And so the question is, are people in Iowa not learning as much, or simply they have a different way of calibrating what they do learn? In other words, this is a question that you ask, and different people might have learned the same thing and answered differently.
With some of the physical challenges with the Healthiest State Initiative, I mentioned the Live Healthy Iowa Challenge. That's kind of easy to measure how many people are participating. And of course, as part of that challenge, you're logging all of the minutes of exercise and all of the things that you do throughout the day. So all of the statistics are right there. You're working on some issues that seem like they would be very difficult to measure. How do we know if we're making progress?
That is a very good question. And when Rick Jurgens asked me to join the cabinet and tackle this issue on emotional health, in particular the lifelong learning piece, if you can call it that, I told him that I thought I had the most difficult challenge because of that issue of measurement. And I think I put together an excellent committee, a team to address this, but one of our first tasks will be to drill down on that question that's being asked by the Gallup HealthWays Index people to find out what does it really mean, and how can we be sure that what people are saying is consistent across states, for instance.
What are you most excited about with the work that you're doing? Is there an idea that makes you most excited?
Well, I think there's two levels here. The governor made the Healthy State Initiative a priority in August of 2011. I think the goal is to become the healthiest state by 2016. Now, one issue there is how do you measure that? And they are using the Gallup HealthWays Index. And so we want to move that needle so that we can continue making progress. I think we're 16th in the nation now. So one level is just the excitement of trying to move us up the rankings in that index. But I think more importantly, and I think this is the view of the people on the committee that we have working on this, is how do we help the individuals in the state of Iowa get more engaged with learning, take advantage of all the resources that we have here in terms of state libraries, city libraries, the cultural things going on across the state. And if we aren't doing a job as well as we should, how do we improve those performances or those services?
Have you changed your behavior based on any of the research you've been doing?
Well, I do enter the office every morning now and ask my staff, have you learned anything interesting today? In fact, I'm entering retirement, and a lot of the research is about the concern that people, when they retire, stop learning as much as they should. And so at a very personal level, this has caught my attention, and so it has put me more aware of how important that is for me individually. But it does change your behavior in terms of making sure that you are maintaining an active learning life.
All right. President Allen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
President Ben Allen of the University of Northern Iowa. He's also the cabinet chair of the Emotional Health and Lifelong Learning component of the Healthiest State Initiative. And as President Allen mentioned, there has been a great deal of research into how our physical health interacts with our emotional health, with our well-being. And one of the people doing that research is here with me now. Patty Akakakis is Associate Professor of Kinesiology at Iowa State University. Hello, Patty.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And you've been studying the connections between physical health and mental well-being for 20 years. This research goes back even farther. One of the first things you studied was how mood was changed by people doing aerobics. Can you tell me about that first study and what you found?
Right. This research goes back to the late 1960s, and it's been a very consistent finding that participation in physical activity improves the way that people feel. And that feel better effect lasts for a few hours after your participation.
All right. So that's in a simple way talking about mood. If mm-hmm. you get moving, you feel better for a while. Mm-hmm. Research over the years has also shown that the impact of physical activity can be much farther reaching as well. What has research shown us about the impact that physical activity can have on depression?
So this research has become a lot more sophisticated since the late 1990s, and now in the area of physical activity, we have several randomized controlled trials, which is an expression that you might have heard. This is the hallmark of good scientific evidence. And the studies seem to be fairly consistent in showing that regular participation in physical activity lowers depression in people who are already depressed, particularly for people who have mild and moderate levels of depression.
And when you say regular participation in physical activity, what is the standard that has been used in this research?
Right. The range of physical activity that you see in those studies that have been shown to be effective is between 3 and 5 days a week. Of course, more is always better. The intensity, I would describe it as anywhere between a moderate intensity walk to a more brisk or vigorous intensity walk. That level of intensity appears to be sufficient, so people don't need to, you know, think that they need to do even more vigorous or strenuous or exhausting forms of physical activity to get that type of benefit.
So we're not even talking about the kind of physical activity that is recommended for improving cardiovascular health.
Some of the studies have actually done less than what is currently recommended. The current recommendation is 5 days minimum, but everybody should aim for 7. And some of the studies have actually shown those benefits with even 3 times a week.
All right. I want to talk more about these benefits and also comparing them to other treatments for depression in a moment. I know that you've also done research into the relationship between our physical health and cognitive health. We're going to get to that in a moment as well. We do need to take a short break. With me right now is Patty Akakakis. He is an associate professor of kinesiology at Iowa State University. And later in the hour, we're going to talk about a couple of other ways that people can use different methods to affect their mood or raise their spirits. We're going to talk about the power of music and also the power of laughter as the hour goes on. We'd love to hear from you as well. If you've been exercising for some time and you have observed how it affects your mood or maybe affects you even more profoundly, you can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can share your story, or of course you can ask your questions as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are focusing on the emotional, mental well-being of Iowans. The Live Healthy Iowa Challenge is focused not just on our physical activity, but also on helping Iowans be healthier in many ways. And we were talking just a moment ago. My guest right now is Associate Professor of Kinesiology at Iowa State University, Patty Akakakis, and he's done a great deal of research into how physical activity affects our mental state, our mood, and can even have a strong impact on depression. And Patty, just to recap, right before the break, we were talking about how research has shown that regular participation in physical activity, so 3 to 5 days a week of moderate or intense walking, can help alleviate depression in some people. Right. With this research, if you compare it to some of the other ways that we treat depression, how significant is that alleviation?
That's an excellent question, and that I think should be one of the key messages from our show today. The evidence appears to be fairly compelling that for the people who have mild and moderate levels of depression, physical activity produces benefits that are no different from the benefits that people get from the more, quote, traditional forms of therapy for depression, which, of course, are psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy. Now, the important issue here to understand is that, especially when we talk about pharmacotherapy, antidepressant therapy, there are significant side effects that affect a large number of people. The success rate, the rate at which antidepressants lower depression sometimes is about 50%, so they don't work for about half of the people and they need to go to additional measures. And of course, there's a substantial cost associated with those. So right now, since 2010, the American Psychiatric Association in its guidelines for psychiatrists says that the issue of physical activity should be brought up in the conversation with the patients. And for the patients who are willing to try physical activity, they should do so.
And you're saying that it is as effective as medication?
As effective as medication, as effective as various forms of psychotherapy.
And again, we're not talking about becoming a marathoner or an Olympic athlete. This is a moderate level of activity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is, again, a very important message to underscore that we're not asking for some of the very extreme forms of physical activity that you might see on TV. What the guidelines are about moderate levels of walking. Those should suffice perfectly.
You have also, in your research, explored the relationship between physical health and our cognitive health. Tell me about the connection there.
Right. So this is also a very important line of research that has expanded significantly since the 1990s. There's consistent evidence from large epidemiologic studies that track thousands of people over time, and they show that those who engage in physical activity have a significantly lower risk of developing dementia and Alzheimer's disease later in life. Perhaps even more interestingly, for people who have already developed the first signs of dementia, such as, for example, problems with memory, participation in a physical activity intervention for 6 months or a year has been shown to not only lower the rate of decline in cognitive functions, but in some cases, and this is pretty amazing, improve cognitive function. Usually, the way that we define benefit in those types of studies is if we see a slowing down of the rate of decline. So the fact that exercise in people have already started showing symptoms has been shown to improve cognitive function, that is an outstanding, astounding finding.
For many years, we were hearing research cited in the popular press saying that, you know, you need to keep your mind sharp to be able to ward off dementia and stay sharp through the later years of your life. And there were recommendations like do crossword puzzles or read a lot. And it sounds like we have a shift here. And I've read studies that have said just this, that physical activity is perhaps even more effective than those kind of mental exercises.
That is what the evidence indicates at this point. In 2010, there was a consensus conference organized by the National Institutes of Health, and they examined all the different types of evidence that we have for various interventions. And in the case of cognitive interventions like crossword puzzles that you mentioned, the conclusion was that there is no clear evidence either way for their effectiveness. In the case of physical activity, the panel was a lot more positive and said that this is one of the most promising interventions for preventing dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
I've also seen research about how physical activity can improve test scores, for example, among school children. What do we know about how physical activity affects our cognitive abilities as children or even in our 20s and 30s?
Excellent question. right now, what we have seen from various statewide surveys is that there is a correlation, there is an association. The kids that are more physically active also tend to perform better academically. Now, that does not necessarily, of course, as everybody knows, indicate causation. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's the physical activity that improves the test scores. So we have to look at experimental studies, studies in which they took kids that were sedentary and then intervened with some type of physical activity to see the effect that that has on cognitive function. And those studies have shown clearly that there are significant benefits in cognitive function for the students, for the children that are physically active for a period of time. Now, the reason why this is so important is because we have a nationwide crisis in the rates of physical education in schools. For a couple of decades now, physical education is seen in some sort of antagonistic relationship to academic achievement. When we need to make cuts and increase the amount of class time, we cut physical education. And the research clearly goes against that.
What questions are you hoping to answer next?
The big question is why people are not physically active at higher rates than they are right now. Because all of those findings are wonderful, the evidence is compelling, but the rates of physical activity across the United States are very, very low. And what depresses me even more is the people who begin physical activity involvement after a while drop out. Unfortunately, the progress that science has made in tackling that particular problem is not as impressive. So right now, we do not fully understand the motivational mechanisms that push people towards physical activity, and we do not understand the mechanisms that push them away. So that is where a lot of research remains to be done.
Patty, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Patty Akakakis is Associate Professor of Kinesiology at Iowa State University. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about our emotional well-being in the state of Iowa. That's part of the Live Healthy Iowa, or the Iowa Healthiest State Initiative, as we hope to become the healthiest state in the nation by 2016. And we'd love to hear from you as well this hour. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have this comment on Facebook. Exercise is so important for both physical and mental health. Often if one is depressed, it's difficult to get out the door and take action. Just take the first steps. Maybe just walk around the block to clear your mind. And as we were hearing from Professor Akakakis, clearly that can have a significant impact on people. And now we're going to turn to something that people have been using to make themselves feel better for hundreds of years, and that is music. Modern therapists have also found value in music. Kate Gefeller is here with me. She's a professor of music and director of graduate studies in music therapy at the University of Iowa. Hello, Kate.
Good morning.
And one of the things that you have explored with your research is the connection between our emotional life and our intellectual life. Can you explain that connection a little bit for us?
Sure. First of all, let me just mention that philosophers and neuroscientists alike have referred to music as the language of emotions. And I think most of us know about that experience of going home after a hard day and putting on music that sort of suits our mood, something that will make us feel better, something that will either pep us up a little bit or else relax us. Well, the interesting thing is that our emotions are not only important in terms of our well-being and do we feel stressed or do we feel relaxed, but our emotions are also a very important part of our intellectual well-being. We find that when people are emotionally healthy, they're more likely to make good decisions, to do better problem solving. And so actually, emotional health and intellectual well-being are very closely related. And music is one of the ways that throughout history we have been able to take care of our emotional health.
Let's talk about how we can use music to affect our emotions, because, of course, music comes from emotion. Most songs emote something or other. When we listen to music, what does that do to our bodies, to our brains, and to our moods?
It's really amazing that human beings are able to take this stream of notes that have many different pitches, many different timbres or tone qualities, different rhythms, and we are able to track that, recall what we heard, compare it to what we're hearing now, and make sense of that. So that's a cognitively very challenging task. Even little children, even infants, can recognize certain types of changes in things like tempo or timbre and that sort of thing. As we get older and as we get more and more practice with this, we start to make more and more fine discriminations. And these fine discriminations that we are able to make in this auditory signal actually appear to contribute to children's ability then to make fine discriminations in things like speech and language. So there is a connection there. But in terms of the mood and that sort of thing, one of the things we know from research is that music that is preferred, that we find to be pleasant and so forth, can actually result in reduction in some of the hormones and neurotransmitters that are associated with anxiety and stress. And we also find that there can be, in some particular situations with some types of music, improvements in the level of things such as oxytocin or endorphin. And these are some of what you might call the good feel-good hormones and so forth. So there is an actual physical change that occurs, a neurochemical change that occurs that seems to be part of this change in emotion that we feel. Music is something that we can use to elevate our mood, and it's not addictive, and we can actually get it for free by listening to public radio and other sources. And it's something that we also use to bring ourselves together socially. Music is something that is a very socially bonding kind of experience. People sing together, they play instruments together, they go to concerts together, they dance to music. And this type of social cohesion is something that also acts as a buffer to stress and anxiety. So in a way, music is helping us through social cohesion, through mood regulation, and by providing a very enjoyable and interesting form of cognitive stimulation.
What is the difference between making music versus listening to music, actually participating in the process of making music, whether you're alone or with other people?
One of the things with making music is that there are oftentimes more motor requirements involved. Musicians, in a sense, are athletes because they have to be using their arms, they have to regulate their respiration. It's a very physical activity to make music. If you are dancing to music, also you're having to coordinate listening to the music, monitoring the rhythm and the beat, and then you have to also stay with the particular movements that you need. So there are a number of aspects that all have to come together in order for those sorts of active making or active response to music involve. Listening to music, one might call passive, but in fact, if you're tracking the music, if you're actually figuring out the structure of the music, it's an intellectually very engaging kind of task. However, music can also be listened to at what we call a pre-attentive level, where in a sense it sort of washes over you. And if you're using it in conjunction with relaxation, it is at a somewhat more quiet response level, a little bit more passive. Both can be beneficial. Studies have been done about active music making. Studies have been done about listening to music. And there are different forms of benefit.
When people have been in serious accidents or had a stroke, you have seen and seen research on music being used to actually help people recover. How can it be used as a tool?
Music is something that acts as a primer to our motor system. there's a term that we use called potentiation. In a sense, a really clear, strong, regular beat helps us with motor planning. It helps us with timing. It helps us to regulate the rate of our movements. We use it every day in things like aerobic classes and marching bands and dancing. But in rehabilitation, it can also be exploited to help individuals who have major challenges in motor planning and utilization of their limbs to get more efficient motor patterns. And also, there's the motivational aspect. It can be very, very tedious to relearn to walk after a stroke or to maintain optimal motor functioning with something like Parkinson's disease. So music that the person really enjoys, that is motivating, and that is also at the correct tempo that's been identified by the physical therapist and the music therapist for that individual at their stage in therapy, can help them to rehabilitate at a somewhat faster rate.
We're talking this hour about our emotional well-being and some different ways that we can use tools like exercise, like music, and coming up in a little while, we'll talk about laughter to make ourselves feel better. Right now with me is Kate Gefeller. She is professor of music and director of graduate studies in music therapy at the University of Iowa. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk to Reverend Laura Gentry, who's also known as Laughing Laura. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We know that Iowa is on a quest to become the healthiest state of the nation. Part of that quest is to improve the emotional health and well-being of Iowans. And that's what we're focusing on this hour. With me right now is Kate Gefeller. She's a professor of music and director of graduate studies in music therapy at the University of Iowa. We're going to continue talking about music for a moment. In a couple of minutes, we're going to turn our attention to the power of laughter as well. And we got a call, Kate, asking about the extent to which insurance companies might be willing to cover a gym membership, since we know about the benefits of exercise in so many different ways. And of course, we have seen a lot of companies, a lot of organizations introduce wellness programs for their employees because they know they're going to have to pay less in health insurance benefits. But we've been talking about the power of music and how powerful that can be in treating people. Is music therapy something that insurance companies will pay for?
Music therapy can be covered through a number of approaches. One is that sometimes music therapists are hired as part of the staff in a hospital or rehabilitation center or nursing home, and so the patient's daily rate includes that as one of the services available. In addition, there are certain types of music therapy interventions, such as rhythmic auditory stimulation for individuals with Parkinson's disease or stroke, who can have reimbursement for that as a result of their being referred to music therapy by their physician. Also within special education, sometimes music therapy has been identified by the child's individual education program, in which case then it is part of the regular package of services that are available to that child. So there are a number of mechanisms that can be used to fund music therapy if it's identified as something that's beneficial to that individual.
All right. And of course, a lot of us self-medicate with music. You know, when I leave work, I know if I'm not listening to news, that I want to listen to music that makes me feel good. And I think that a lot of us do that. A lot of us use music to make ourselves feel better, but a lot of us also choose music that matches our mood. And sometimes that can be very sad or even depressing music. How does choosing something like that influence our state, choosing music that may be on the sadder side?
It's interesting that even neuroscientists have been fascinated with the idea that people sometimes are drawn to sad music. There's something in music therapy called the ISO principle, and that means that if a music therapist is working with someone who is in a current mood, there's initial recognition and understanding of that mood that they're currently in. So the therapist may actually start with music that, in a sense, matches that person's mood. And then if you're hoping for some mood regulation toward a more positive mood, in the case of someone who's depressed, you may move them toward a slightly more upbeat, more positive, happy type of music. On the other hand, there are people who are overly frenetic. And in that case, what we're hoping to do is downregulate the level of arousal. As far as what you listen to in everyday life, you know, you have the opportunity to select music that is a good match for where you're at. And then you can gradually change the music to, in a sense, reflect more where you'd like to be at if you feel that your current mood is not where you would actually like to be. In fact, there are theories called optimal arousal theory that suggest that people choose music to get to the level of arousal they want for their current situation. So when you go to a party, you're not really trying to go and really relax and be snoozing in the corner. There you want something that's a little bit more upbeat, that keeps you a little bit more alert and elevated. On the other hand, if you're trying to really relax, slow down your breathing, then you want to choose music that has probably a slower beat, that has less disjunct types of harmonies and that sort of thing.
Well, and if you have been to an event with a really great DJ, they seem to understand that as well, because they can manipulate the mood of the crowd.
Absolutely.
Through the music that they play.
Yeah, and movie makers have known for a long time that they can use music to, in a sense, manipulate the mood of the audience. They can put us into feelings of terror. They can make us feel very romantic and lovey-dovey. They can make us feel a sense of impending doom. They can give us a sense of triumph and that everything's going to be just fine. They can give us a sense of we are all in this together. So, yes, mood can be such a great way and a non-addictive way to modify our moods.
Lou is on the line in West Branch. Hi, Lou.
Hi.
What's your question?
I wanted to say hello to Kate. I know Kate. The thing I wanted to first say is that I was lucky enough to, my music mentor lived to be 107 years old. She was originally a silent film theater organist. And during the Depression, after she lost her job doing because of the talkies coming in, I asked her how she kept her mood up because she was living hand to mouth for many years, and she said she just played the blues away by playing the piano and playing the theater organ as much as possible. She played up to about 6 months before she passed away in 2010 as a professional theater organist, still playing the silent films. I wanted to ask Kate if there has been any studies concerning musicians, even conductors, about their emotional well-being and their longevity, because theater organists are using their left hand, their right hand, their left foot, their right foot in a different way. They are getting so much exercise and using their brains in different ways, much like a trap drummer does. My question is, has there been any studies concerning that?
Yes. Actually, musicians are athletes, as well as bringing us great aesthetic pleasure. There have been interesting studies that show that individuals, older adults, individuals, say, in their 70s and 80s, who are engaged in making music, and those who do social dancing to music, are two groups that tended to have higher cognitive functioning seem to have a reduced rate of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. So the making of music is very much like you described, Lou. It is really a lot of active involvement on a physical level, an emotional level, a cognitive level. And keeping all of that going with our executive functioning is really quite a challenge.
And that brings us back to what Patty Yakakakis was talking about with the effects of physical activity on our cognitive health as well.
Absolutely. And so playing an instrument or singing is very physical. And moving to music is also a great way to bring together the beauty of music and its emotional lift that we can get in addition to the motivation to keep us moving. And in fact, we've seen a number of studies where people who had difficulty with maintenance to a exercise regimen were able to stick with it for a longer period of time, more consistently, when they did it with music that was really meaningful to them, and also when there was some social support. In other words, they were with other like-minded individuals.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for your call, Lou, and I want to move on to laughter now. We all know that having a good long laugh can help us feel better, but there are some people who think that we should not wait for laughter to come to us, and the Reverend Laura Gentry is one of those people. She's also known as Laughing Laura. She's a minister at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Lansing, Iowa, and she operates the Iowa School of Laughter Yoga. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
thank you so much for being with us today. What is laughter yoga?
Laughter yoga is simply a delivery system for laughing. We all know how to laugh, but often we're serious and we don't laugh enough. So this is a way that we get people to laugh regardless of their circumstances. We call it unconditional laughter because you laugh contagiously with people and it absolutely changes your mood immediately.
Well, I think we all love to laugh, but we do tend to wait for some outside stimuli to make us laugh. How do you force the laughter?
It is true that we wait for outside stimuli, and that's a shame because some days just aren't funny enough. And so by utilizing this method, we recognize that you can laugh just because you want to laugh. Our bodies are wired to laugh, in fact. And one study by a laughter researcher named Robert Provine found that we are 30 times more likely to laugh if we're with a group of people than when we are alone. So in the laughter yoga movement, we get together in clubs, and we fake a laugh, basically, and it's so ridiculous that we all begin laughing because when we're together with the objective of laughing, it's kind of impossible to not laugh in that circumstance.
How long do you think it takes to turn that fake laughter into real laughter?
I think it's instantly. Some people find it really a little disarming to come and, you know, fake a laugh. They think that it's not authentic. And I think it turns into real laughter so instantly that I don't even call it fake laughter for myself anymore. I mean, I open my mouth and start laughing and it feels real to me right away.
What do you do? I mean, how long are people together in one of these classes or gatherings?
The actual hearty belly laughing goes about a half an hour. Some clubs meet for a whole hour so they can do some exercise stretching at the beginning and some cool down and relaxation meditation at the end.
And how do you keep it going for a half an hour?
Well, we combine it with yogic breathing. That's why it's called laughter yoga, and it sounds more difficult than it is. It's truly breathing. That's it. And so anybody can do it. We do this in the nursing home. Even when people have no mobility, they can still exercise, which is so good for them. And, you know, we talked about the runner's high earlier today. Laughter does that. It's another form of exercise. And so we get the laughers high. And we do exercise after exercise where we stimulate the laughter by pretending something. And we get in a playful frame of mind, which makes laughter really easy because that's why children laugh so much.
When did you become interested in the power of laughter?
Well, it was about 8 years ago that I'd heard about it, that there was this worldwide laughter movement that sprang forth from India in 1995, and I got really curious and finally told my church they needed to send me to laughter school so I could start Iowa's first laughter club. And that was 6 years ago that we started it here in Lansing.
And when you started to do this research, when you started to find out about it, what did you see that made you think, yes, this is what I want to be a part of?
Well, the positive social support, and we all know that that's a key component to emotional health, is having the right social support. And we live in a society that's increasingly busy. People are in activities, but they don't often have meaningful social interaction. Even at church, we really want to encourage people to engage in meaningful fellowships. So I just thought it would be a wonderful way to bring people together to have a positive social interaction. And we say we have no political or religious agenda. We just come and laugh. Now, what kind of a club is that? It's a great club.
How has it changed your life?
Well, it certainly has given me a much better tool to fight stress. You know, we can become so stressed about our lives because our lives are stressful. But when we laugh, it actually engages the parasympathetic nervous system. And so that causes our body to reverse the effects of stress. So your life can still be stressful. You just don't care anymore. You're just laughing your way through it. So it's a resiliency tool that enables me and the people that I work with to really weather the storms of life much easier.
And can you give me a couple of examples of how you've seen it help people that you have worked with?
Oh, absolutely. There are, if you go to laughteryoga.org, that's the international laughter website, there are stories they post every day. But one of my students had fibromyalgia. She had a lot of physical pain, and so associated with that was depression. She came and took the training and went home and said, I'm going to laugh every day, and she did. And she's no longer living with that level of pain. She said her pain level was about a 9, 10 sometimes, and now it's like a 1, 2 on a pain level. And, you know, for the first time, she got to go ice skating with her child, and she had never done that before. So it allowed her to get back into life in a really amazing way, just by laughing. It sounds ridiculous that laughter could do this, but it has so many benefits for us.
Well, it seems like laughing in a group, as you've been describing, would be a different kind of experience than laughing intentionally alone. Do you have guidelines for people who want to try laughing at home?
Absolutely. You can totally laugh alone. I have learned the big aha for me with this is that you don't need a reason to laugh. Actually, you just burst out with a laugh by yourself, and you will feel dumb about that. And so you laugh at yourself. So you actually crack yourself up. So you just laugh, and that will help you to laugh further. Even though you didn't know that was possible, you just try and it works.
So is this something that you do at
home? Absolutely. I think we need about 20 minutes of laughter a day. That's what some laughter experts recommend, your daily intake of laughter. And you can get that. And I say, you know, laugh when you're in the shower. Laugh at yourself in the mirror. Laugh when you have a stressful situation. Laugh while you're driving, and then other people will laugh at you, and then you can laugh back and just have fun with it.
Well, a lot of us engineer situations where we can laugh. We listen to comedians. We watch late night shows on television. We watch funny movies or funny television shows. Is that as helpful, do you think?
It is. It's absolutely helpful. And wherever there is a way to make you laugh, you know, hang out with funny people. Go to those humorous shows and, you know, add more comedy and funny toys that make you laugh. You know, there's a lot of toys that laugh now. Just have one on your desk. Simple things like that will give you just a little initiative to get yourself laughing.
And I do know that April has been designated as Laugh Out Loud Month by the state of Iowa. So clearly you're not alone in recognizing the value of laughter.
Isn't that wonderful? Last April, there were a lot of exciting events around the state of Iowa. And I'm looking forward to this April. So get ready to laugh out loud again.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Reverend Laura Gentry, she's also known as Laughing Laura. She is a minister at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Lansing, Iowa, and operates the Iowa School of Laughter Yoga. And Kate Gefeller, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome.
Kate Gefeller is a professor of music and director of graduate studies in music therapy at the University of Iowa. And I want to read a couple of comments that people have been sending in through the show. Kate in Cedar Falls said, I think emotional health needs to be fostered early in our lives, the idea that we need to nurture and take care of ourselves. Here are two ideas I've used with my daughters. One, I've created an I've had a hard day plate that they can use at supper time if they felt especially down or stressed. It's like a symbol of their stress. And then we can chat about their concerns over our meal. Two, let your child have a mental health day every once in a while. Grown-ups secretly take them from time to time, and children should be able to do this as well. And Susan also writes to say that sleep research shows that deep sleep is essential to our emotional and physical well-being. We've been talking this hour about our emotional well-being. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow is Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.